I mean, we joke all the time about how just how high maintenance we are. It's like we think about like, gosh, we can't go there or do that or that. We're just too high maintenance, you know?
Hey friends. Well, number seven is like the perfect number. Ah, this might be the perfect episode. Yes, I'm Dave Trout, and this is UTR's Green Room Door, Season 7, Episode 7. How about that? And this is a really special one because we're doing something we've never done before, and we'll tell you about that in just a sec. This is the penultimate episode of Season 7, so Episode 8 will close out, be our season finale. And we know who our guest is going to be. Yes, think Grammy Awards. We're going to be talking to a big-time guest in the next show, and we'll reveal who that is at the end of this episode, so stick around for that. But, hey, that is not to undersell this episode, because, yes, there's a Grammy Award winner on this particular show as well. But before we get to who our guests are, I'm so excited that we are doing, for the first time ever on this show, like a multicast cross-pollination, a partnership with another podcast. We are very good friends and collaborators with Jessica Morris, a music journalist and podcaster from Australia. And she has a fantastic podcast called Between You and Me. It's similar in our ethos. Like, we both desire to talk one-on-one with artists, get to know more about them and the music they're making, the heart behind it all. And so we thought it'd be really fun if we did this interview together and then released the full conversation on both podcasts. So the latest episode of Between You and Me has this interview that we did, as well as, of course, this show on Green Room Door. So that's one thing we're really excited about. The second thing is our guests today are just, man, such a treat. Charlie Peacock and Andy Ashworth are, I'm going to call them, a powerhouse married couple in the Nashville community. I know they would probably roll their eyes at that, but they are really a force of good in the world and have made a huge difference and impact in so many people's lives and in a variety of ways, just using their own strengths, talents, abilities. It's really beautiful. And they've been married a very long time because they got married as teenagers. I think they were like 17 and 18 or something like that when they got married. So they're well over 40 years of marriage. They just have such great wisdom and experience. And they have put some of those thoughts down in a brand new book called Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much. And I just loved this book. It's the best thing I've read all year. It's just full of encouragement, wisdom, and it's very invitational. It calls us into to live a life of hospitality and grace. And there's many things that I'm still kind of chewing on. And we're going to talk a lot about the content of the book in the episode today. But I thought I would start by reacquainting you with our guests. First off, Charlie Peacock, I know, needs no introduction, but some of you may be late to the game, so I just want to spend a moment to let you know that, of course, most of us know him because of the music that he has made as a solo artist. He has several albums and really has toured the world and just put so many great songs into the world. Starting in the mid-1980s, I know that he was actually playing and doing a variety of music before that point, but kind of became that Christian music artist in the mid-80s all the way, really up until today. He's still releasing just great quality music. And so let's just give you a little taste of some of the music that he's released through these decades. And I know that barely scratches the surface of what has been a really historic, legendary career in the music business. But interestingly enough, as much music that he has made and put out into the world, Charlie is primarily probably known by most people as an award-winning producer. And he has been at the helm of the production of just some really big and important projects, some music that some of it was hugely commercially successful and some of it just really influential. And here's actually even just a taste of just some of the monumental influence that he has had as a producer. Here's some of what he's produced.
Follow me, here I go. Won't do me no good washing in a river. Can't no preacher man save my soul.
Oh, fall down,
So yeah, you get the idea. Charlie has just put his fingerprints into the music world in a way that is second to none, and is an amazing producer, amazing performer, solo artist, amazing songwriter, and also just a thought leader in the music community, the art community at large. He and his wife, Andy Ashworth, co-founded Art House and also continue. Andy continues as the editor of the Art House America blog. Andy Ashworth is also a published author. She has the book Real Love for Real Life, which came out through the Rabbit Room several years ago. And just continues to be an impact in the community at large. Well, we are just thrilled to have them on as our guests of honor. And now that you've been thoroughly introduced, next we're going to dive into an extended conversation. It's almost a full hour long. And so here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick sponsor break. This will be the only break in the show. And then when we come back, we'll dive into the interview and we'll just have that uninterrupted. Also, we're going to be connecting with Jessica Morris on the other side of the world. She's in Australia. And we together interview Andy and Charlie on in conjunction with her podcast, Between You and Me. This is a fun collaboration. I'm glad that we could partner on this one. So, and Jessica does a really fantastic job with the questions she asks and stuff. So it was just a delight all the way through. So we'll be back in just a minute or two, and we'll dive right into the uninterrupted interview with Andy Ashworth and Charlie Peacock after this on Green Room Door.
UTR podcast is sponsored by the latest album by singer-songwriter Matt Wheeler.
It's so pleasant a place. You don't expect to see a boy so solemn for his age.
A Hard History of Love by Matt Wheeler is music inspired by the writings of Wendell Berry.
A Hard History of Love. A Hard History of
Matt Wheeler's A Hard History of Love is released through Old Bear Records and is available now on Spotify and all music platforms.
He's a Grammy Award-winning producer, songwriter, author, and podcast host. We're talking about Charlie Peacock. And we are celebrating Charlie in UTR's latest contest.
Because we're a big man's hat.
Win his brand new book, a vinyl reissue, rare coffee mug, and an autographed CD. Enter to win for free at utrmedia.org or click the link in today's show notes.
This podcast is sponsored by the new single by Dustin Starks.
I know your love can't be contained, 'cause you're greater than what remains.
What Remains is a new anthem of hope and perseverance by indie singer-songwriter Dustin Starks. You can find it now on Spotify, Apple Music, and all music platforms, or in the link in today's show notes.
Well, this is super fun. First time this has ever happened. Jessica, it's so great to be hanging out with you together on both of our podcasts.
Yes, it is so exciting to join you, Dave, for like UTR Media, Cross Between You and Me. I am so happy to be here for this.
Yeah, so it's we're really excited, most of all because of our guests that are with us today. We're going to be hanging out with Charlie Peacock and Andy Ashworth and talking just a bit about them, but also about the new book that just came out. It's called Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much. And so just to kind of, well, first of all, welcome, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. So good to be with you guys.
Yeah. I just thought it'd be fun before we dive into the book content, just to kind of find out what are the things that immediately come to mind that are currently life-giving for you, whether it's things you're involved with or things that maybe you're just consuming, different art or projects or whatever. What are the things that come to mind that are life-giving right at this time?
You want to start?
Sure. I'll say, well, it's almost gardening season. So that's very life-giving to me. And I'm just counting the days till my garden begins to bloom and I go outside and I start planting. And then I think anytime that I can be with a really good book and give my attention to a great, I've got a couple going right now. Yeah, I've got too many going and I've turned a little bit, my attention is not great these days as we're doing book promotions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not my usual thing, but it's been difficult to stay with a book longer, but I've got some good ones going on. Time with our family, time with friends, those things are all life giving to me. Yeah.
Gosh, mine are, I have a new electric bike, which Ooh. I love. So any of you listeners that live in a hilly environment like we do, you know, which we really have almost zero level streets here in Green Hills, Tennessee, where we live. So it's great to be tooling along and then decide, oh my gosh, this is just too steep, and then give it a little bit of juice. So I'm loving that and working on new music and working with my son and my granddaughter too as well on that. Love that. It's track season. And mm-hmm. so our grandson is an athlete. So we like to go watch him. Plus he plays this thing called 7-on-7 football, which is not, you know, American football. So, I mean, it is American football, not soccer. And that is really life-giving to me. I love to be in the stands and cheering him on. And, you know, just Easter was amazing because we love our small Anglican fellowship that we're a part of here in Nashville. And we love being with our family. And so gathering with our family and just hanging out, just talking, eating too much. We played with chickens. We played football. Gosh, yeah. And just, you know, 4 or 5 hours, we did so many different things. It was, yeah, very life-giving. Mm-hmm. So that's my greatest hits for today.
Nice.
I love that. Yeah. You two, your life is so full. You do so much. You find delight and joy in so much. Why was now, 2024, why was now the time for you two to collaborate on your book, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much, and release it and share something so personal with the world?
Yeah. Well, I have to just raise my hand and say it was my small idea that I presented to Andy about 2 years ago. And the idea originally was to publish essays, previously written essays, for our art house communities and just, you know, kind of people who would be interested in our ideas over the last couple of decades, right? And then our agent, Don Pape, took that and ran with it and found a wonderful acquisitions editor and developmental editor who loved the idea of Andy and I writing something together. And but she really wanted us to take the ideas that were in the essays and write them as letters and expand on them as much as we possibly wanted, and just kind of said, you just do your thing and I'll edit from there. And so that brought new blood, new life to it, and it became kind of a bigger partnership between the two of us rather than just collating or compiling, you know, previously written essays. And the next thing we know, we got tricked into writing a new book. The editor sort of tricked us into, and then we woke up one day and said, hey, we're writing a book from scratch together, aren't we? And so that's how it's been. But it's been an amazing experience. And just the idea that we could take the things that have formed our lives, the sort of core ideas that we would have thought of them as art house ideas in terms of the ministry that we had for so long and has now gone out from Nashville to other cities. And we just would have thought, okay, these are kind of art house type ideas, right? These are like the foundation of what we do and people care, culture care, music making, family, being a good citizen in our city, all of that. And that's what the book became. It became letters to people in various circumstances. And it really is sort of, I would say it's kind of our greatest hits. It's like Andy's greatest hits, my greatest hits, and we bounce off each other. And somehow in the grand scheme of God's providence, it all seems to be woven together and integrated without us having to really try too hard to do that.
And
Jessica, I think when we've thought about this, we realized we had to be old enough and have gone through enough stages of life to be able to do a lot of reflection too. So we couldn't have written the same book even 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
Well, one of the things I love about the book is there's like lots of nuggets of wisdom that the reader can sort of absorb and contemplate and walk away with and chew on. But at sort of the heart of the book is actually like a lot of vulnerability. All these letters just come from lived experiences, and you don't even shy away from some really hard moments in your own life too. And so I'm wondering, when you think of these 16 different letters that this book represents, for each of you, was there a particular letter that might have been even more difficult to write or more difficult to share publicly than any of the others?
Yes, for me. I think we didn't have anything. We didn't have in all of the pieces that we kind of stripped down and started over with, we didn't have anything on marriage, just a little bit. But when the editor told us, I think there is a chapter on marriage waiting to be written here. And she appointed me to do it. And I just thought, oh boy, okay. You know, so it was hard to begin. But as it turns out, I had some little bits and pieces that I had written in the moment as we were going through a very difficult time, or I had written them shortly after that. So I really had a good starting place and then went from there. But just the idea of trying to capture, that's such a big topic, especially when you have been married for decades and together for decades. And of course, you have, you know, lots of different lifetimes inside of that one lifetime together. So that one was probably the most difficult.
Yeah. I mean, in the moments in the book that are more memoir, autobiography in terms of style, I mean, I think that's always a challenge to figure out, you know, what am I sharing that is intimate to my life that really belongs to me? And it's this moment where I have lived long enough or matured enough that I can share this without, you know, going to sleep that night and laying awake all night wondering if I'd done the right thing or not. And then for us especially, we're always sensitive to not oversharing because of our children and grandchildren, and also just being cognizant that not all stories we can tell are our stories to tell. So, So that you factor all that in, you know, when you're thinking about writing things that are pretty intimate, and you know that, okay, well, you know, this is out there now. It's gonna last. You know, someone will copy it. It'll be on the internet. It's gonna be out there. Hopefully, no one will get a tattoo of it.
You can right. never guarantee that in Nashville. Let's be honest.
But... Yeah, it's not that.
True.
Now, with everything that you're saying, like obviously you've been so choiceful in what you share, in how you've written it. It sort of leads me into, there's a letter in there particularly about what it means to be like an active citizen, a good citizen in like your community, but also in the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. It sounds like taking these steps to so thoughtfully put together these letters and share them is part of being, I would say, like an active citizen. But could you, either or both of you, expand on that idea for us? Like, what does it mean to be an active citizen as a creative or as an artist?
Yeah. It started for me thinking about what it is that I steward. And I actually put this in the book that I wrote, New Way to Be Human, which has been, it's 20 years ago now. And that's when I first kind of explored this idea of personal stewardship in terms of how it works with vocation and with citizenship. And just the idea that if each of us would make an inventory of what we have stewardship over and be really specific about it and don't self-edit a bunch of things. Like, you literally could say, hey, I have a hose, you know, outside I have a hose, I have a bucket, and I have a cracked pot, you know, and you could say, okay, well, that's what I have, you know. And then you could say, well, what would you imagine for your front door when people walk up to your door? And, well, okay, I can imagine a lot, but I don't have the money for it. You know, it's like, well, all right, what could you do? You know, could you mend the pot? You know, could you do something cool with the bucket? You know, whatever it might be, it's just to stir that thinking. And then imagine that being multiplied, you know, 500 times by all the other things you steward. It also helps you clarify what you really value. And I think that's so important. And so once you've done that personally, you can do that, you know, you can sort of like step outside the door and look down your street, right? You can say, okay, you know, I have mutual stewardship over this community here with my neighbors, right? And what am I doing to build the community that I want here in terms of taking care of infrastructure, taking care of relationships, being hospitable, all those kinds of things? Then you could expand even further from that, right? Because then you could start to say, well, I want to be involved in the politics of the city. I want to make sure that our city doesn't grow at such a pace that it leaves a whole bunch of people behind. So you might get involved in that part of it. There's just so many ways to engage. It really is, once you start thinking that way in terms of what you have stewardship over, there's just no room for boredom. You know, there's no room for indifference. I mean, that's how you put yourself all the way in.
Yeah, I love that. That is really challenging, but
it's super challenging.
So pivotal to why we all do what we do.
Yeah, but it's empowering too, because it's to say that, like, I do have control over a lot of aspects of my life. In a world where we, you know, if all we did today was read the news, we might think that, oh my gosh, we have no control over our life. Things are just insane. But we do have a lot of control over hundreds of things that we can ask a question about those things, and we can say, can we make this better rather than worse? And we all have the power to do that in some small way.
Yeah. Love that.
Thank you.
Jessica and I, you know, our podcasts primarily focus on music and, you know, and let's just call it what it is, that we target sort of this Christian music world, whatever that means. And we, I think Jessica and I both define that very loosely and very holistically. But I think it was the third chapter of the book, The Christian Name Game, where you grapple with what it means to be a quote Christian artist.
Yeah.
And so my question is, why does it seem like we care so much about labels like this? And then where do those labels just start to fall apart?
Yeah, well, I think it's important, especially for me. I mean, I guess in terms of me wanting to be known and to be understood, is to say that I'm not someone who goes out and picks fights about, you know, naming things Christian and not naming right. things Christian. I really, like, when I talk about this subject, it's something that's very passionate to me because it's deeply linked to me as to what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, to be a Christian, right? To be in the party of Jesus, right? And that's why it's so serious to me. I completely understand that if you want to have a Christian gardeners collective, and you really only want Christians who are gardeners to become members of this collective, that you might go out and say, hey, please come to this place on December 5th, etc. We're going to have the first ever Christian gardeners collective meeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
I totally get that. I see that. And that actually might be the smartest thing to do if you really want to find all the Christian gardeners in your community, right? So I'm not speaking against that. What I'm saying is that there are certain parts of society and certain parts of the church, and particularly the American church, with relationship to music, where there's an assumption that if you are a Christian and a musician, then you make Christian music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in reality, you know, we could have a theological discussion about it and determine, yes, in fact, you are making Christian music. But the problem is there is a brand and a genre known as Christian music. So if I'm a Christian and a musician, and I even say, hey, I'm a Christian musician, and then I play some music for you, and you say, what's Christian about that? Right? That sounds like a Jewish cantor singing over the top of some turntable beats, you know, with a sousaphone in the background with a whole bunch of reverb on it. I don't even know what kind of music that is, right? And so you get really confused about it. Well, I understand that. That's because I play lots of different kinds of music and create lots of different kinds of music. So when I want to have the freedom to go out there and do this weird turntable sousaphone music, right? And I don't want you to think that it's necessarily Christian music in terms of a brand or a genre. I would just love for you to say, I either like it or I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I would like, you know, in my version of reality. But I totally get it why people name things Christian. And the primary reason, and I think you guys will admit this, is that if your audience is Christians, you want to tell the Christians, hey, come over here.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
this is what we're doing over here. You know, we're Christians doing a Christian kind of thing over here that you'll probably be interested in. And so I totally get that. That has not been my calling. It's been people have confused me as having that calling, but it never has been my calling.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I want to throw this question to Andy, particularly. You both talk a lot about community in your book, and community in the context of family, of friends, of, it would seem, random people coming up to your door for many years and inviting them in for a meal. Community that extends different classes and types and backgrounds of people. And there's, in some sense, there's nearly an innate knowing in all people, like, that we need other people, we need community. But what does it look like for you to be intentional in your everyday life to actually seek out the community that you need, not just giving yourself to people, which you do beautifully, but to actually seek out what you need?
Yeah, that's so great, because it looks different now. You know, we're in a different season, so we don't live in the same house doing the same kind of very open-doored hospitality that we did for over 2 decades at the Art House in Nashville. So now I think it looks more like being really intentional about both reaching out but also receiving invitations from our friends and making space, making time, making that priority. It can look like just knowing the names of our neighbors, and as much as we can in the, you know, we're in a particular season right now with a new book and in the writing of it. So, you know, not as open doors as I would love to be in that way, but also just going out on a walk and be able to talk to people and know them, and knowing that I know the names of my neighbors and I know something about them, and vice versa. And that is important. I think it's in what we, our present fellowship is very important to us, our Anglican fellowship, and we're beginning to know people in greater ways in that place and with those people, and even in that form of a different way of being in a church fellowship than we had been before that. So I think that's what comes to mind. And then the community of family, it's always, you know, really important to us, and especially because we do have grandchildren, and knowing them, being known by them, being with them, creating memories with them, having conversations with them, being interested in what they're interested in, that's all really important to us. So that kind of community as well. Yeah,
if you don't mind, I want to dig a little bit deeper on that, because I feel like if I was to summarize the book in one word, if that was at all ever possible, which it isn't, but if I was to summarize it as one word, it would be hospitality. I just feel like your life, the way you live your life, the choices that you've made, the way you prepare meals, the way you prepare music, like it's all a gift of hospitality. And so I think that sometimes that word is often misunderstood, though, because as even people in the church are encouraged to be hospitable, oftentimes it means basically say yes to everything that you can, or be present everywhere. And your book does such a beautiful job of talking about boundaries in as well as openness. Can you speak to that, just the importance of holding those two things in the tension of hospitality?
Sure, I think we can both probably say something about that. You know, one thing we have really had to grapple with for ourselves as we age and as we both have different chronic pain issues, that a lot of times it is our bodies that just tell us you have to have boundaries. Like you can't say yes to everything. You can't say yes to everybody. You really do have to be more focused, I think. And, you know, whereas we used to say yes to almost everything and everybody, then there came a time in life when we really couldn't do that, and we can't do that now. So we do have a different way of being our hospitable selves than we did in a different season, in a past season. But I think that's both natural to aging and also the wisdom of aging, probably, to say, you know, it's hard earned. It was hard earned for us to even learn in the art house that, whereas we barely had any boundaries for so many years, we kept trying to find a sustainable way of living and being married and doing this other thing and, you know, coming to know our own needs was really important, and also important to us being actually, I think, better human beings, because you can't be a human being without having needs of your own, and then you can be better with other people when you do recognize that, have a more sustainable life with others. So that's been part of it. Yeah, the aging and the, you know, experiencing some pain issues that just stop you. They just say, you know, you can't do anymore. That's it.
Yeah, I think if we were to just say, what's an idea of what comes to mind when you think of a hospitable person? To me, is just somebody who lets you in.
Mm. You know, that's good.
It's like they have a welcoming countenance to them. They let you in, not just their front door, but they let you into their lives. They're not necessarily oversharing, but they're just, what you see is what you get. You know, and I think when you ask for that and pray for that and to be that kind of person, and you're incrementally changed into that kind of person, then that's so hospitable, because it sets people at ease that they can just be themselves. And I think for us now, that's probably the best thing that we can do. And so in some ways, writing the book is a way for us to be able to travel around without traveling, you know, to deal with, like, I mean, we joke all the time about how just how high maintenance we are. It's like we think about, like, gosh, we can't go there or do that or that. We're just too high maintenance, you know. But we could write a book, a welcoming book, and put that out. And I feel the same way about the music. I mean, I'm, you know, making all kinds of music, and it's really just a way of saying, hey, what about this? You know, does this make you feel anything? Is this interesting to you? Do you want to come on in? You want to visit for a while, visit the music for a while? If you don't, it's cool, you know? But it is really made with that kind of innocence and just asking, what does it mean to love God's world, to love what Jesus loves, and to find a lot of different ways to express it, not just one way or just 10 ways or 100 ways or 1,000 ways, but the millions upon millions of ways to express that love of what Jesus loves.
Yeah. And obviously one of the central ways that that has been true in your life has been the art house. It's kind of like a recurring character in the book and in a lot of these letters.
Yeah, it is.
And I'm just kind of curious now, you know, the Art House America continues as a blog, and there's other art houses that are continuing in physical form. The original Art House now has been sold to somebody else and is in, you know, other hands. So there is a bit of a rear view mirror, if we might say, to like that chapter or that piece of your life. So where do you compartmentalize that? Is that like the fulfillment of a dream, or is it something, is there some other thing that you think of when you just kind of think back on the art house?
For me, it might be a dream, as in, did that really happen? Like, did we really do that?
Yeah.
Because it was pretty intense, but at the time, it's the life we were being given. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's what it comes down to for me, is when I was a young woman, or let's say in my late teens, because we got married when I was 19 and Chuck was 18, I would not have dreamed that up. I had no way of dreaming that up or foreseeing it or imagining that would be our life someday. And so when it was given to us bit by bit, and we really followed God into it, it wasn't just like we had this grand idea and vision what the next, you know, 24, 25 years of our life would look like, but it was us following little bit at a time. First of all, getting from California to Nashville, and then in Nashville, buying this old country church, understanding a little bit, just a little bit. And Chuck was the visionary on that for sure. But then it was both of us coming in and saying, okay, here's a little bit more as we understand it. Here's a little bit more as we understand it. And none of it done perfectly, that's for sure. Us being very human in the midst of it, or especially me, let's say, being very human in the midst of it, in that, you know, just be really feeling what it was like every day to have a home that was very open, to do daily hospitality of all sorts, and also do larger gatherings, and also raise a family in the same place, and mm-hmm. have artists making records and staying in the house, and just all this blend of things that I really learned to do and responded to along the way, but did not dream it up and could only understand it little by little as I was living it, and then in hindsight. So that's kind of my story with the art house, is wow, that was an amazing ride. That was really an amazing ride. There was a lot that was really challenging about it, but a lot that was so beautiful, and incredible memories, incredible people that we got to know and have in our lives, either for a long time or a short time.
Yeah, when we were very young Christians in the early 1980s, one of the things people would say is, they'd say something about some event or occurrence or something. They'd say, wow, that was really of the Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, that was really of God, or, you know, God was really on the move, or some kind of way of expressing that, right? And I'm not one who necessarily uses that language. I mean, I'm sure I did back then, but I would say with great confidence about the art house, wow, that really was of God.
Yeah.
You know, and just, I can just put a period on it right there and just say, thank you. Thank you, Lord.
Yeah. And also the ongoing
work still going. Of
the art houses and also the people who, Nate and Cassie Tasker, who moved into the house after we left, and they continued.
People who are inspired. There's a group called In Sparrow in Birmingham, Alabama. That's kind of our sister organization, inspired by Art House as well.
But yeah, we did not really dream, or at least I don't think we did, of a spread like that. But it was more like when Art House Dallas and then Art House North were coming into being. I think I was so used to living that life that I just couldn't imagine what it would mean for it to go somewhere else. Because it would, to me, it was just ordinary life. I couldn't stand outside of it and kind of extrapolate most important things that could translate somewhere else.
And each art house has a very, they're very different, you know. Sarah and Troy Groves up in St. Paul, Minnesota, are probably closest to what we did and what Nate and Cassie Tasker did here in Nashville. And Art House Dallas has all of the ethos and the theological bedrock, but they're more of pop-up, and they use a lot of different facilities, and they're very, very program-oriented with just amazing. They serve like hundreds of local artists, and they are very art-centric and community formation and outreach are their three main pillars. And I mean, they do like, you know, 150 events last year. I mean, there's something going on in the greater DFW area, like almost every night practically. So they're, yeah, it's amazing the work that they do. And we're just honored to have been there to, you know, kick the can down the road in the beginning.
Can I just want to dig very quickly. Sorry, Dave, I know we've got set questions. I just want to dig really quickly into that if I can. What was it like to extrapolate your identity from the art house when you made the decision to move on?
So hard.
Very hard.
Very, very hard. Yeah, I really didn't know who I would be without that place, because it had come to be so much a part of who I was and what I did every day. You know, it just felt like that place was our second skin. Like if we would introduce ourselves, or kind of, you know, when you're in the conversations where you tell about who you are, what you do, all of those things, that would always be part of it. Well, we live in this 100-year-old church and we do this thing that's, and then we would try to explain it, and it was hard to explain, but it was so centered in place. And because we had really taken this old place and renovated and made all these choices, and I had planted gardens there for really 20 years worth of gardens, and which had so many memories. And so all these different choices in terms of what we want it to look like, how we want people to feel when they come, how we want the scent when they open up the kitchen door, what we want people to smell, and then just all of the fun memories, you know, that we had there, both with our family and with other people. So all of that together, along with Chuck having his studio there and having been, you know, made all these amazing records there as well. And that was also connected to, was the music, but it was the people, and it was meals we'd had together, and it was all those things mixed up. So when we left, I just thought, I don't know who I'm going to be without that. I was in a vocational disruption, I think.
That's a good one.
Yeah. So it took a while.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
I also just want to throw, this is a quick question. I don't know if this is a quick question for Charlie, but you talk about cultural paternalism and confronting that, understanding that, and you pledge to winnow it out. Now, Andy, I'm sure that there's elements of this you can speak into, but particularly because Charlie wrote this letter, I would love to know succinctly, if that's possible, I would love to know how you started on this journey and what it actually means for you to do the inner work so you're not judging or condemning yourself for maybe previous behaviors or biases now that you've identified that there has been a cultural paternalism in your life.
I don't have any sort of like major ill feelings towards myself. It's more of a slow revealing that happened through investigating my ancestry over several decades and coming to terms with various things that happened in our larger family on my father's side. And also investigating the migration of the family from the South and from the Midwest to California as a place of hope and a place of where there would be work, you know, and sustenance and just the kind of mindset, the risk mindset of like leaving everything to go to this other place, you know, the migrant, the immigrant mindset of like making this huge risk. And then also the gender distinctions in the middle of that risk, like what roles genders would play in that, right? And so being raised in an environment where you know, men don't crack, they don't break down, they never stop going forward, there is no problem that cannot be solved, you know, those are the kinds of things that I was raised with. And I was a very sensitive kind of arty little kid, and but that was the environment that I grew up in. So I'm a product of both being, you know, a young musician and moving in that direction of everything that the arts had to offer and literature. And I was privileged to have some good special educational opportunities as a young person. And so I had all of that, but I still had that way of being a man in the world that was so deeply connected to my family. And then we also came up together, both of us, during the pinnacle of the feminist movement. So we were figuring out gender roles and who was going to do what and whatnot in our partnership. But I think more than anything, just the idea that I'm a fixer or a rescuer, or I have the answer for something. It's one of those things where, in a lot of instances, that's true, okay? But what isn't true is that I'm a fixer for you or a rescuer for you, right? And I think that what happened with men in my generation is that we stopped having boundaries. And we moved from having a mission that was family oriented to a mission that was society oriented and became bullying, where, you know, you have an answer for everything, you have a cure for everyone's ills, and if you'll just listen to me, and so on and so forth. So me just sort of discovering that and discovering other aspects of my manhood and about the way that I was raised and the men in my family, I think that's just been an important part of my development as a human being and as an artist, to come to terms with that because it's a real mix of not just the paternalism piece, but it's also a mix of the kind of renegade, rebel, you know, the solo voice. I mean, everything that I was raised with in terms of the artists, if you think about rock artists, singer-songwriters at the time, you're the person who goes to the mountaintop, right, and gets the vision, and then you bring it down for the people. That was so much in the ethos of the time. So I've just been investigating a lot of those things and, like, you know, keeping what's good, tossing out what isn't, and just trying to grow.
Again. Well, the book has been put out into the world, and so obviously the creation of it is one thing, but now it's put into the hands of readers, and obviously you can't control how it's received, but I'm sure as the writers, you guys have wishes, hopes, dreams for the different emotions and feelings that it will evoke for the reader. So what are some of the hopes that you have as somebody engages with the book?
I think my hopes are so often when I write, I really hope that people see the value of their own callings in the world. And even understanding the word vocation as a pretty big word to contain an individual life and all of its parts, its relational parts, and the gifts that you have and the way those are lived out in the world, and the way you serve in your family, community, cities, in the world, you know, all the ways that that looks very unique and individual. It's been really important for me to understand that. So I have, I think, a lot of respect for maybe the quieter aspects, the parts that don't get a lot of shouted into a megaphone, but do make up the part of what it means to be human on the planet and to care for other people and to care for each other. So as my hope is always that it will help people in the telling of our own stories as honestly as, you know, we could. It will, maybe somebody else will say, well, I see something of that in my own life, or I can translate that into this specific thing in my own life. And I feel like I can respect it more, or I can listen more, and I can see that God, you know, is calling me in all these different ways, and I can feel good about that and not be waiting to live another life or only value, you know, this one part of it, but not the whole thing. I think that's always my hope.
Yeah, I would agree. We really want people to read the book and walk away with the idea that there's this, that the real heart of life is lived in a space that is, it's metric free. You know, there's not someone keeping score, and you're not being judged by your neighbor's score. You know, if you have one and they have a million, you know, and you are somehow less, we really hope that people will walk away with that. We hope that they'll walk away with a big vision for life, but not one that makes them feel small. Instead, empowers them to say that whatever I can steward, in however I can do it, however proximate I do it, never perfect, then all I need to do is get up tomorrow and pray to be hopeful and just take a step. That's it. Just take a step. Make a single choice that leads to another choice. There's no big, massive plan. There's not 10 points to follow. It's more about an openness of mind and heart, a dependence upon God, a desire to be neighbors to one another, and to truly, as I said, love what Jesus loves. If you're not sure what that is yet, give that some thought. You know, I'm pretty sure you're going to find out that it's like everything from worms to quarks and quasars and that neighbor you don't like. You know, it's going to be a big inventory. I guarantee you that.
Yeah.
More than you'll ever count in your lifetime.
Love that. Dave, I'm going to throw to you now. If you want to add an extra question, you go for it, or feel free to close it up, but you take it wherever you'd like.
Okay. That's cool. Well, I thought it would be nice, just in our, we have a, just another minute or two, just to Charlie, to let you share a bit about this new title that you've added to your resume, which is podcaster.
Oh, okay.
can you share a bit about the podcast that you're doing with Christianity Today?
Yeah, I'm coming after your jobs, you guys.
I know.
The threat is very real.
Please do.
The threat is real. Oh gosh, I think there'll be room enough for us.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I love doing the podcast. I think it, at this time in life, it brings together a number of things that I'm interested in, but I'm also have some experience with. And so the podcasts tend to be like, you know, kind of like producing an EP or something. And most of them, unless they're what we're calling the four on the floor, which is when I have a group of people that we're doing more of a traditional interview with, most of them are pretty highly produced in terms of all the original music that goes into them and Foley and all of that, and try to make them entertaining and tackle a really wide range of subjects, from things that are current to, you know, doing some kind of Easter egg stuff from, you know, 30 years ago that maybe, you know, some of the people who found me first through Christian music will be interested in and like. And so I'm just kind of following the, as Andy says sometimes about how we got started with Art House, is just following the breadcrumbs. And Mike Cosper, who's my producer, he and I work pretty closely on deciding which direction we're going to go. So coming up, I don't know, you know, when this will air, but I'll go ahead and reveal that episode 10 is me with Michael Omardian, Brown Bannister, and Keith Thomas. So you have the producers and the three main hit songwriters, and we're all discussing Heart in Motion 30 plus years later.
Wow.
And talking about all the inside stories about the making of that album. So that'll be coming up in episode 10. And then we have four more episodes after that, and that will end our first season. So we will have 14 episodes for the first season and start up again in September. And amazing. So we've got a lot of ideas on the table for that, and we'll see where it goes. But thank you for asking about it. Yeah, Music and Meaning with Charlie Peacock. It's every other week on Tuesdays, drops on Tuesdays.
Very cool. Yeah, I've been loving every single episode. It's ear candy for me.
Yeah, my favorite so far was episode 8, when people sent in questions.
And, oh, yeah.
Because it gave me an opportunity not to just do like a Q&A, like, here's the question, then I give an answer, but to actually produce the answers, like make, you know, a whole little almost segment just out of their question, you know. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah. Neat. Well, very fun. I'm so grateful for you guys. Thanks for your time, and Jessica, anything else you want to add in?
Oh, no, I just want to say thank you, Andy and Charlie, so much for your time, but also for your wonderful book.
Thank you.
Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. It.
As we know, is available at all good bookstores, and I'm very jealous that I wasn't in Nashville for the book launch at Parnassus.
Which is an amazing bookstore. Yeah.
It was great.
Very good. Thanks, you guys, for all your support.
Absolutely. All right.
Yeah. Jessica, thanks for being with us from so far away. Time. Yeah.
Thank you for sticking out, Tornado Watch, or whatever the crap one is.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Glad that you're all still here.
It's over. Yeah.
We weathered the storm.
You did.
You're good.
Ah, a true delight. Wasn't that fun? I'm glad you hung out for that full extended interview. And just have some housekeeping and some acknowledgments and thanks and some links to point you to right now. First off, a big, big thank you to Andy Ashworth and Charlie Peacock. It was such a delight to for them to make time for us. And would love to point you to the new book, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much. That is through W Publishing and Thomas Nelson. And we're going to send a link to The Rabbit Room, who is selling that book as well. That's kind of like our preferred seller. But it's available on all book platforms if you want to check that out. And we'll link to that, like I said, in the show notes today. And a big thank you to Jessica Morris. We love working with her. She is a fine member of the UTR Critics panel. She has helped with some of our blogs and even some behind the scenes work. And it's just such a delightful person. We're going to link to her podcast, Between You and Me, just so you can discover it and save it and subscribe to it and start listening to it. Those are the main two things to point you to. Right now, we are having a special Charlie Peacock contest for our listeners. You can throw your name into the hat. We're going to be drawing a winner this month who's going to receive that new book that we just talked about, plus a signed CD, a rare Charlie Peacock coffee mug, and the vinyl LP reissue of West Coast Diaries Volume 2. That whole Charlie Peacock collection could be yours, so it's free to enter the contest. There's a link for that in the show notes today, or you can go direct to utrmedia.org. All song clips used in the first few minutes of this podcast were with permission or under fair use provisions. Well, I teased for you at the beginning of the show that in our season 7 finale, which is coming up on the next episode of Green Room Door, we have a very special guest who is a Grammy award-winning singer, songwriter, and we can tell you right now who that's going to be. We are thrilled to be doing an interview with Dan Hasseltine, who is the lead singer and principal songwriter of the Grammy award-winning band Jars of Clay. And currently, he is one of the main sound designers for the TV series The Chosen. We are going to have a great conversation with Dan coming up on our season finale of Green Room Door, which will be the next episode. Well, we just couldn't do any of this without an amazing UTR support team. Thank you, friends. If you are a part of the crew that is contributing and donating and supporting the work here. Yes, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. Anybody who contributes donations, that is a tax-deductible gift and helps to continue us produce content and deliver it for free worldwide. We are delighted to do that. And hey, if you'd like info on joining the support team, we'd be honored to have you on board. And you can find that at our homepage, utrmedia.org. This is a very fun, very special show. I'm so glad you spent some time with us. I'm Dave Trout, and you've been listening to the Green Room Door Podcast, a production of UTR Media, an independent, listener-supported nonprofit ministry in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and online at utrmedia.org.